I'm Michael McCusker. Well, as everybody probably knows, this is Black History Month. And I'd like to read something that I have written. I call it The Emancipation of Abraham Lincoln. It's almost a annual event that I read this, with here and there a little touch-up, a little rewrite. And I have to say that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in the entire universe. Though I hope not, and I don't expect it is. I'd like to start it off with a couple of quotes. First, from a fictional character, Hobie Tucker, et al. The United States is guilty of original sin, and that sin is slavery. And from Martin Luther King, Jr., there will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. And, of course, that quote is a little problematic in the sense that he only says his citizenship rights. And it's rather ironic in a sense that Black History Month butts up against Women's History Month next month. The Emancipation of Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln, the 16th President of the United States, will be 202 years old on Saturday. He was born February 12, 1809, and was murdered on Good Friday, April 14, 1865, at the age of 56. He was shot in the back of the head while attending a stage play by an embittered actor who thought his single bullet would reverse the loss of a civil war just ended. For most of the world, Lincoln is the symbol of the United States. For Americans, his worn, gaunt, and terribly sad face is our conscience. He is revered as almost a saintly human being, and, with Karl Marx, is probably the other most significant political figure of the 19th century, and certainly the most compelling in American history. Lincoln grew to power from poverty and obscurity. He was raised on the frontier and taught himself law. He is probably the nation's most successful politician. Just prior to his election as president, he was hardly known outside Illinois. At his inauguration in 1861, he was the most reviled man in the country. Yet immediately after his death, he was regarded the most beloved. He almost single-handedly held the sundered Union to its successful and awesomely bloody purpose of defeating the secession of the Confederacy. More than almost any man of his era, he grew to understand the importance of the unity of the United States. Without unity, the nation would be the victim of other rapacious powers that wish to obliterate the fledgling split democracy and expropriate its vast spaces and incredibly rich resources. He passionately believed the doctrine of political freedom would disappear from the world if the U.S. dissolved. Ironically, his election as president severed the nation, and just as ironically, the division of the nation centered on the question of political and individual freedom of black slaves. Although Lincoln believed that the gradual abolition of slavery was an historical inevitability and the intent of the majority of the framers of the American Constitution, his dramatic act of emancipation halfway through the Civil War, more than any other act, made him one of the most memorable and important figures in history. Lincoln had very little personal acquaintance with slavery, though he had witnessed it on the river landings of Missouri and southern Illinois, and in particular during his single term in Congress in Washington, D.C., which at that time, in the 1840s, was a major warehouse for the slave trade, by then illegal, but not slavery itself. He thought slavery violated the doctrine of equal rights, but he never quite abandoned the idea of white superiority. For most of his struggle against slavery, he did not believe that whites and blacks could coexist without economic dislocation and violence, and he preferred establishing colonies of former slaves in South or Central America in much the manner as Liberia in Africa. He was opposed to immediate emancipation and initially believed that slavery could be slowly and patiently eradicated without disunion. He thought a policy of containment by free states would eventually strangle slavery. The secession of the Confederacy altered his hopes. Though he still believed emancipation would lead to catastrophe and initially resisted radical abolitionists, he needed a strong, clear driving force to continue support for the war against the Southern states to justify the intensifying bloodiness and appalling Union losses. He also wanted to instill terror in the South, which had always been haunted by the specter of a massive slave uprising. Yet he wished no revenge upon the South, unlike many Northern politicians and abolitionists, and his original plans for Reconstruction following the war gave no political power to the freed states in the defeated Confederacy, nor were they to be allowed to vote. Although he became convinced that blacks and whites would have to remain together because separatism was infeasible, he continued to believe the status quo had to change gradually if change was to be successful. It was his feeling that several generations would have to pass before blacks were capable and educated enough to assume political power. Their chances for economic freedom were nil, and it is probable he was also aware that sudden enfranchisement of power and wealth would result in a brutal backlash against blacks in both North and South. Lincoln might not have been able to prevent the opportunistic revenge upon the South, but his death ensured it. Its result was a counter-revenge, not upon the white carpetbaggers who infested the South at the end of the Civil War, but upon freed slaves who were terrorized and murdered. White supremacy groups grew up on the fringes of Southern anger, the most dominant and ruthless the Knight Riders of the Ku Klux Klan. Lynchings of blacks were commonplace following the Civil War and lasted until the seventh decade of the 20th century. After nearly a century and a half after emancipation, the United States has finally elected a black president. Yet a decade into the 21st century, the overwhelming majority of American blacks are still without position or power. And although the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s dramatized and somewhat improved black prospects, the pervasive racism that continues to saturate American society strips away the few advances that have been achieved. American history is taught from primarily a white perspective, which is only a portion of our history, and without integrating it with black American history, it is irrelevant. And worse, it is a lie that perpetuates the racism that underlies and embitters our truly pluralistic history. African blacks and European whites were parallel colonizers of the Western Hemisphere. And together they built the civilizations that currently exist in North and South America. The primary difference is that black immigration was a forced migration. Millions of blacks were brought in chains from Africa as slaves for 400 years. Slavery evolved as the result of the need for an abundant and relatively cheap supply of labor in the American colonies, and the traffic in slaves was itself probably the most profitable international trade in history. Entire industries were built on the commerce of human slaves, and as cruel as it was, which induced an opaqueness to the torment inflicted by the trade, the extent and profitability of slavery built cities and helped raise the capital that started the Industrial Revolution in England. Much of Africa was emptied to provide slaves for the European colonies in the Americas, and most of Africa was colonized by European nations. Africans who were not sent across the oceans as slaves were enslaved at home. No one will ever know precisely how many millions of blacks were killed in their villages in four centuries of slave raids, but it is estimated that about one-third of those captured died en route to the coasts or while imprisoned awaiting embarkation, and another third aboard ships in which they were chained and stacked like cords of wood in overcrowded, filthy holds, and during the seasoning process of slavery, worked to death in stifling climates, beaten and murdered if they were slow to obey or attempted to escape. When the slave trade was finally declared illegal at the end of the 18th century, its illicitness made it even more profitable in much the manner as the current international drug trade, and as with illegal drugs, when capture is imminent, uncounted thousands of black men, women, and children were thrown overboard to drown in the ocean, chained together, whenever a naval patrol caught up with a slave ship. The trade was also profitable because it was easier to work a slave to death and buy a new one than it was to breed and feed newer generations, although that, of course, was also done. Slavery in the Americas took two separate directions. In the Spanish and Portuguese colonies in South and Central America, slavery continued the long tradition of Mediterranean slavery, practiced most famously in classical times, and was incorporated in the Iberian Catholic religious doctrine, which claimed that although slaves were of the lowest social order, both masters and slaves possessed souls that were regarded as equal by God. The tendency, therefore, was that slaves were human beings with some rights and some legal means by which they might achieve freedom. Roman slaves were granted not only freedom, but much prized Roman citizenship. The legal structures of the North American colonies and the British West Indies, and later the United States, did not recognize slaves as human beings entitled to human rights. The ancient and medieval experiences with slavery had been forgotten, and Northern Europe did not have a comparable tradition with the Iberian nations. There was no slave law and no concern for blacks in their religious doctrines. More problematic for the future was the tendency of Northern Europeans and Americans to identify blacks with slavery. The mere fact of being black was presumptive of slave status. Slavery was considered perpetual, and chances of working toward freedom were few. To be black was to be a slave, without rights to marriage, children, whose value was only as prospective slaves, property, or to the product of their work. Yet despite the differences of the slave systems of South and North America, they were only differences of degree. Wherever there was slavery, there was a slave society, not merely for blacks, but for whites also. Blacks and whites were bound together in cruel and bitter antagonism, but also in complex relationship that could not express itself without reference to each other. It was a class relationship that became ever more defined as a racial one. North American Southern society in particular was enclosed and closed off by its slave system. To quote C. Van Woodward, "The ironic thing about these two great hyphenate minorities, Southern Americans and Afro-Americans, confronting each other on their native soil for 3.5 centuries, is the degree to which they have shaped each other's destiny, determined each other's isolation, shared and molded a common culture. It is, in fact, impossible to imagine the one without the other, and quite futile to try." And that was the late C. Van Woodward. Southern slave society grew from the same historical conditions that produced the world's other slave regimes. The rise of a world market and the need for cheap labor encouraged slavery, and only the advent of mechanical technology and industrialism rendered it inefficient and ultimately incapable of competing in the very market that created it. The South was haunted by its guilt and fear of slavery. Enslaving blacks was justified through claims that it was God's intent that whites were superior to blacks, that slavery civilized blacks and elevated them above their former status as jungle savages, and that in essence whites were carrying out God's law by making slaves and Christians out of pagan blacks. In reality, Southern plantations were battlefields where slaves fought masters for physical and psychological survival, and although they were unlettered, outnumbered, and unarmed, black slaves struggled in as many ways as they could to preserve their humanity against virtually inhuman odds. Southern whites bitterly resisted acknowledging the humanity of their black slaves, a contradiction of their claim of God's edict to Christianize them. Underlying their pious justifications was a terror of the system they had fabricated. The culture of the antebellum South was continually in dread of slave insurrection, and any outbreak was savagely suppressed. In a sense, a reason for perpetuating slavery was the fear of reprisal once it was abolished. Most Northern whites also considered themselves superior to blacks, and the desire to abolish slavery had more to do with its interference with paid labor than with human rights. Even a majority of the northern abolitionists who had risked imprisonment and their lives providing underground systems of escape for runaway slaves felt, as Abraham Lincoln, that blacks should dwell apart from whites. Yet ultimately, however intense the economic dialectics regarding slavery, and perhaps because the climate of industrialism allowed it, the most important reason for the abolition of slavery was the moral one. The idea of an inherent value of an individual outlasted slavery and was the chief source of its undoing. There were many reasons for the division of the young nation, South from North, but at its core was the inhumanity of slavery. Frank Tannenbaum, in his book Slave and Citizen, wrote that inherent in the history of slavery was an important contribution to the theory of social change. Wherever the law accepted the doctrine of the moral personality, and that's a quote, of the slave, and made possible the gradual achievement of freedom implicit in such a doctrine, the slave system was abolished peacefully. Where the slave was denied recognition as a moral person and was therefore considered incapable of freedom, the abolition of slavery was accomplished by force, by violence and revolution. We cannot separate our history from the long centuries of slavery. Without black slaves from Africa, much of the Western Hemisphere would not have been converted into an enclave of European civilization. The fight for independence that characterized the American Revolution did not include liberty for slaves, and the oversight caused the Civil War 80 years later, which began 150 years ago this year. Emancipation only brought a semblance of physical relief from slavery, but its underlying racialism, has not been eradicated nearly a century and a half later. If the class system of slavery is defined by color, then a post-slavery society becomes a form of apartheid, which has been the result in the United States since the Civil War, and which was starkly dramatized in the violence unleashed against the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s. We begin the third millennium of our era still a divided nation, and as Lincoln said, though he was not the first to say it, a house divided will not long stand. Blacks as well as whites wish for separation, but there is really no other place to go. Just as whites are no longer Europeans, American blacks are not Africans anymore. For better or worse, blacks and whites are hybrid Americans. Slaves are free. The arduous, tragic, and unequal role of black Americans in building and defending the nation has always been devalued and generally ignored. Just as the word history seems to imply only male endeavor, his story, so does it also imply Western, European, white dominance and supremacy over world affairs. Yet the black struggle for civic and social equality, especially in the last generation, has been the most inspiring and closest to the revolution of the Enlightenment of the 18th century that gave birth to the United States than any other. This struggle is a continuation of what Washington, Jefferson, Adams, et al., started and unfortunately denied people of color, and that's a quote, who were regarded as property rather than persons born equal and certainly not born free. Lincoln's Executive Order of Emancipation went into effect January 1, 1863. Though it abolished slavery in the Confederate states, though not those under Union control, it was probably not legal according to U.S. civil law. To remedy any deficiencies in the proclamation in regard to its legal standing, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution was introduced in Congress in 1864 and was ratified in 1865, the year the Civil War ended. It abolished slavery or involuntary servitude in the United States or anywhere under U.S. jurisdiction. The Emancipation Proclamation, though it raised the conflict for union to an issue of international moral principle, had little initial practical impact because Lincoln at the time had no authority in the Confederacy. Lincoln had proposed the proclamation the previous summer. Secretary of State Seward suggested he wait to announce it until a significant Union battlefield victory so that European governments would not misinterpret it as a final shriek in our retreat. And that's a quote from Seward. Lincoln had said at the start of the Civil War, "If I could preserve the Union by freeing all of the slaves everywhere, I would do so. If I could preserve the Union by freeing none of the slaves, I would do so. If I could preserve the Union by freeing some of the slaves, I would do so. His critics and some supporters thought the proclamation was a cynical act by a weak, vacillating president. Yet by conceding the free the few, he struck to the heart of the conflict and never afterward wavered from his promise. He got his victory at Sharpsburg, Maryland, on September 16, 1862, near a little creek and a church named after it that forever gave the battle its name, Antietam. The Union Army routed a Confederate invasion of the North. It was the single bloodiest day of the Civil War. At least 15,000 dead on both sides, and another 20,000 wounded or missing. Union losses alone were twice as many as those of the Normandy D-Day landing 82 years later in 1944. 5 days after Antietam, Lincoln issued his proclamation. Quote, on the first day of January 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall then be thenceforth and forever free. If my name ever goes into history, Lincoln said, it was for this act. It took a century and a Southern president, a member of the Party of Traitors, that was the Democrats, and they are still called that, to take the next step of what emancipation began. Lyndon Baines Johnson, successfully pushed through Congress the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights of 1965. He said, 3.5 centuries ago, the first Negroes arrived. They came in darkness and in chains. The story of our nation and of the American Negro are like two rivers that flow through the centuries along divided channels. When the Liberty Bell rang out in Philadelphia, it did not toll for the Negro. When Andrew Jackson threw open the doors of democracy, they did not open for the Negro, or for that matter, Native Americans, whom Jackson exiled to the far west and forced onto the Trail of Tears. To continue Johnson, it was only at Appomattox a century ago that an American victory was also a Negro victory, and the two rivers, one shining with promise, the other dark-stained with oppression, began to move toward one another. But rivers of blood course between them. That same year of 1965, the Watts Riot in Los Angeles erupted, and later on, In 1991, the worst domestic riot in U.S. history occurred at the same place because white police who savagely beat a black man senseless were acquitted by an all-white jury. With few exceptions, American blacks are contained and isolated in urban ghettos in much the manner Nazis forced Jews into European ghettos. They are denied adequate education, employment, housing, education, or health care. Forced to subsist on deleterious doles, stingily appropriated, which are exploited as examples of the need for abolishing welfare altogether. Their rage is forced inward against themselves. The barely constrained contempt whites hold for blacks is probably equally felt toward whites by blacks who are victims of the antipathy, but outnumbered 10-1 and without the tremendous legal strength and firepower of the whites, they are generally unable to strike back without horrendous consequences. Not all whites are racial supremacists, though most are racist, if not intentionally, usually on impact. Yet although whites have fought for and some have died for civil rights for blacks, the prevailing white attitude towards blacks was summed up in 1857 by Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Roger Taney, when speaking for the majority in Dred Scott. He stated that Negroes were considered so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, quote unquote. Racism will only end when children of every race are taught early that the color of skin is far less than the quality of hearts and minds. That will not be easy. No less than the essential education system of the United States must be uprooted and rewritten to reflect the common struggle of both races to build and survive in this country. Then perhaps Lyndon Johnson's two rivers might converge. We cannot escape history, Lincoln said to Congress. We will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trail through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor, to the latest generation. And that was something I wrote, The Emancipation of Abraham Lincoln. Now I'd like to read something along that line about American exceptionalism, idea of providential destiny in play against Obama, by Jonathan Zimmerman, and it appeared in the Sunday Oregonian December 19th, 2010. Is America exceptional? All countries are different, but does America differ from all of them in a fundamental way? Does it have a special purpose or destiny in the world? That's becoming the battle cry of the Republican Party in its bid to unseat President Obama in 2012. Sarah Palin, Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, Mike Huckabee, and other GOP presidential hopefuls have all declared Obama insufficiently attuned to American exceptionalism. America's exceptional, they say, except our own president doesn't appreciate it. His worldview is dramatically different from any president, Republican or Democrat, we've had, charged Huckabee. To deny American exceptionalism is, in essence, to deny the heart and soul of this nation. The charge that puts Obama and the Democrats in a different spot, difficult spot, pardon me. According to a recent poll, 58% of Americans agree with the statement, God has granted America a special role in human history. Whether we are exceptional or not, then, most of us believe we are, and it would be political suicide for Obama or anyone else to suggest otherwise. Instead, the president should invoke America's long tradition of left-wing exceptionalism. The great warriors for social justice in our history all insisted that America had a providential destiny. Unlike present-day conservatives, however, they also indicted the nation for abandoning this mission. They used American exceptionalism to critique America's vices, not just sing its virtues. Consider the abolitionist movement of the 19th century, which routinely invoked the nation's divine purpose and its founding documents to condemn slavery. In the first editorial of his magazine, The Liberator, William Lloyd Garrison quoted the Declaration of Independence, assenting to the self-evident truth that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I shall strenuously contend for the immediate enfranchisement of our slave population, Garrison wrote. I will not equivocate, I will not excuse, and I will not retreat a single inch, and I will be heard. He was. So was the great African-American abolitionist Frederick Douglass, whose famous 4th of July address in 1852 cited the same document. Quote, the Declaration of Independence is the ring bolt to the chain of your nation's destiny, Douglass intoned. The principles contained in that instrument are saving principles. Stand by those principles. Be true to them on all occasions, in all places, against all foes, at whatever cost. But by enslaving black Americans, the nation contradicted this core doctrine. It also violated the Constitution, Douglass insisted. Interpreted as it ought to be interpreted, the Constitution is a glorious liberty document, Douglass argued. Read its preamble. Consider its purpose. Is slavery among them? True, Douglass admitted. The Constitution did say that those bound to service for a term of years would be counted as 3/5 of all other persons. But it made no explicit reference to African-American bondage. If the Constitution were intended to be a slaveholding instrument, Douglass argued, why neither slavery, slaveholding, nor slave can anywhere be found in it. After the Civil War, as the nation industrialized, labor activists would likewise invoke America's providential origins. Even socialists got in on the act, quoting Thomas Jefferson rather than Karl Marx. The Socialist Labor Party of the United States reasserts the inalienable right of all men to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the party's 1896 platform declared. With the founders of the American Republic, we hold that the purpose of government is to secure every citizen in the enjoyment of this right, but no such right can be exercised under a system of inequality. Finally, and most famously, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. would quote the Declaration in his I Have a Dream speech in 1963, calling on America to, quote, live out the true meaning of its creed, unquote. And that creed, King made clear, was both distinctively American and divinely inspired. But America doesn't have a monopoly on it. The creed is universal, after all. All men are created equal, and women, and endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights. America is exceptional because it is the foremost embodiment of these principles, so it also has a special responsibility to uphold them. That's precisely the kind of exceptionalism that Obama and his party need to reinvigorate right now. To Obama's Republican critics, American exceptionalism is synonymous with American superiority. We're not just different, we're better. He should reply with a full-throated defense of a different kind of exceptionalism, one that underscores America's historic struggle to realize its proclaimed values. That doesn't make us better than anyone else, but it does give us a special duty to fight injustice wherever we find it, especially in ourselves. And that was by Jonathan Zimmerman. I'm Michael McCusker.